This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Tom, Rich and Brandy with you this morning. Having a look at yet another property record. This time it's for transaction volumes, highest like ever. We've had Zahn Jahinki, who is the man in charge of the numbers at Property Monitor, and Cavendish Maxwell coming in to tell us what that tells us about the market. Diamonds. Richard is worried that they might be losing a little bit of their twinkle with De Beers up for sale. We've been speaking to Fergus James of Fergus James Diamonds this morning. We've also been having a look at what's happening with Nvidia. No sooner did it join the $3 trillion club as it became a target for antitrust investigations in the US. We crossed to Australia this morning to speak to Jessica Amir, who's market strategist at Moomoo.
One of our top stories today is that European Central Bank interest rate, cutting rates. First time since before the pandemic, 2019, the last time the ECB cut rates. Yesterday, they were expected to do so. Christine Lagarde, the boss, did not disappoint.
The Governing Council today decided to lower the three key ECB interest rates by 25 basis points. Since our meeting in September 23, inflation has fallen by more than 2.5 percentage points, and the inflation outlook has improved markedly.
Happy days. Okay, one interest rate cut, but one swallow does not a summer make. What's going to happen next? Well, Christine Lagarde, unsurprisingly, kept her cards close to her chest. She said, anything will be data dependent. We will decide meeting by meeting. This was the only clue she gave.
We know the path we are on, but we also know that there will be other bumps on the road. There are bumps that we can more or less predict, but there are bumps on the road that can come as a surprise. But we know it's going to be a bumpy road, let's face it. The next few months will continue to be bumpy.
They will be bumpy for Europe, but what about the United States? Let's be honest, that's the one we really care about, because US interest rates are UA interest rates. The US has not budged yet, but we have had a couple of dominoes fall this week in terms of interest rate cuts. We wanted to get the thoughts of Jean Walter, senior economist, Emirates NBD, and we asked her very simply, when will the Fed follow suit?
We've seen the start of interest rate easing cycles in two of the G7 countries this week, with both the Bank of Canada and the ECB cutting rates by 25 basis points this week. Market attention will now shift to the Fed with the FOMC meeting next Wednesday. While some of the economic indicators in the US are starting to show signs of cooling, inflation is proving sticky in its current range. We think that this means that the Fed will keep rates on hold at next week's meeting, but that the committee is likely to be in a position to start cutting rates in September, with a 25 basis point reduction expected then, with this then followed by another 25 basis point cut in December.
There you go, an interest rate cut in December under the Christmas tree, but you got to wait till then for the second one this year. So that is the money markets. Not the only market we're covering today. Brandy, in about 15 minutes' time, turn our attention to the real estate market. We got some breaking news out, haven't we?
Yeah, we have indeed. Zahn Jahinki, chief number cruncher for Property Monitor, and Cavendish Maxwell, has spotted a new record. I'm not stealing his thunder, I don't think, by saying that for May. He's also got a couple of trends that he thinks we should keep an eye on. He's going to be in at 8:30.
Live in the studio, Zahn Jahinki, so looking forward to that one very much indeed. Also looking this morning at the diamond market.
I've been talking about my new diamond rings, because my new diamond rings are better.
Because multiple reports this week suggest that the diamond industry may be losing its sparkle. You've got prices down about 30% from the highs seen in 2022. The IDEX Diamond Index down at about 105 points at the moment. It was about 160 back in 2022. And Anglo American has put De Beers up for sale. De Beers, of course, an icon of the diamond industry. We wanted to find out what's happening here in Dubai. Sanjeev Jain is managing director of Ratan Sajan Diamond here in Dubai. They're based in Almas Tower and they've been in Dubai since the 1960s. He's the second generation of that family to run the organisation. So we asked him about a couple of trends when it comes to diamonds here, in particular Dubai being a diamond hub. And he said, while globally, sure, there is a bit of a lull at the moment, for Dubai, business is booming.
The capital of the diamond industry used to be once upon a time in Spain. Then it moved to Amsterdam. Then it moved to Belgium, where it was there for a pretty long time. And now it is Dubai. It is Dubai, really. It's hard to digest, but yes, it is Dubai. It's very easy to move the goods here. It's very easy to import, re-export. The government is so friendly here. So the natural diamond industry is very good here.
So we want to know if this is just a short-term lull for the diamond industry. That's certainly what Sanjeev Jain thinks it is. Tom, you're speaking to a diamond expert a little bit later on this hour.
Yeah, we are going to get another source, an opinion on this one. We're going to be talking to Fergus James, the British jeweller, albeit based out of Almaztower. So does that therefore suggest the theory put forward by Ratan that Dubai is a hub for all things diamonds or not? A question we'll put to Fergus a little later on today and ask him... Well, babe, can I have the questions that you had a minute ago? Can I have those? Because I'm going to do the same for Ferguson's and we're going to compare notes.
You know, we were talking about the James Blunt concert earlier.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's funny.
Yeah.
I'm on the platform formerly known as Twitter. He's got a Netflix documentary coming out.
Is he really?
Yeah, 18th of June, called One Brit Wonder. And as he says himself, this is the story of an ageing British pop star still fighting for relevance some 17 years after his star momentarily twinkled.
Mm. I was looking on LinkedIn, because you know, James Blunt's a kind of pop star for our generation, for business breakfast listeners. And I was looking on LinkedIn, looking at Sam Instone, who's the head of AES.
Ah, oh, they were in the same... Is it Richmond?
Yeah, there's a picture of Sam and James Blunt last week in Dubai saying, catching up with my old army buddy, James Blunt. I mean, you know these guys reasonably well, Tom. You're very discreet about your relationships, but James Blunt has mates here in Dubai, doesn't he?
Lots, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots. Sam... I think they serve together. Harry Amos, who's based out here as well, good friends with him. Jim. Yeah, there's a load of them. No wonder he keeps coming back to concerts out here. He's got a good battalion of buddies out here.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's move from oil to the other Dubai commodity, which is, of course, the housing market. Real estate also moving the needle in the economy here, and we have quite the cracker of a May report coming out from Zaan Jahenki, Chief Number Cruncher, but to give him his official title, COO of Property Monitor and Director of Market Intelligence and Research at Cavendish Maxwell. He does this every month. It's not the first record that he's noticed. Morning, Zaan.
Very good morning to you.
Right. Tell us this month's record.
I think we've titled the report My Oh May, and Was It a May? We have hit a brand spanking new transaction record of over 17,000 properties sold in a single month. That eclipses the previous record way back in 2009 by about 20%. So we've rocketed. If you go back and think pre-COVID, we were doing 2,500, 3,000 transactions a month. And that was a good market where lots of deals were happening. So the volume of transactions that are happening now is absolutely astounding. It's been driven largely by off-plan. About 67% of that market, those transactions, are off-plan properties.
Okay, because that was going to be my question. Everyone says that you can't find a house for love nor money, so how are we managing to sell so many of them?
It's the off-plan market. I mean, if you look, so up to the end of April, we're at 40,000 properties that had come to market on the off-plan space, so units. We're still doing the numbers for May. It's going to push it over 50,000. So we're looking at more than 10,000 units in the off-plan market coming for sale a month. They're going to materialize and hand over 3, 4, or 5 years from now, depending on which the project is. So you've got a lot of people that haven't been able to find something in the ready market to move in, and they're making that compromise for, look, I want to get something. I want to lock in a price now. I'll buy something off-plan and then move in 3 to 4 years' time.
So talk to me about price, because that's the number of houses that are being sold. But what are we seeing in terms of what they're transacting for?
Yeah, so anyone that listens to me prattle on will know that I don't like seeing price growth sort of above 1% month on month, because it starts to run away, right? 10% or more price growth in a year is starting to get scary. We started this year sub 1% for a couple of months, and then 2 months after that, we had really big spikes, right? One of about 2%, then 1.5%. It's started to moderate again, 0.69% last month, tapering down. The reason that we're seeing that, though, is it's a mixed a change in the type of units, the quality of units that are transacting. So we had a big jump when there were some higher quality, larger ticket prices coming in, as well as in some of the older communities where you've got more, let's say, dated inventory. Take somewhere like Arjan. You've got a building 10 years old, trading at 1,000 dirhams a square foot. New launch comes in at 1,500 a square foot. That's obviously driving up average prices. So have to remember, it's local. We're talking Dubai as a whole. Break it down community by community. You're seeing different trends in there, where some of the older communities are appreciating faster because of almost quasi-gentrification. And then you've got some of the more, say, the newer communities or the ones like in a Business Bay or Marina with a big healthy mix, and there has been over time, which aren't seeing as rapid appreciation.
Talk to me about these off-plan launches. Because you do the numbers for this, don't you? What was the last estimate you put of how often we were seeing an off-plan launch?
So it's sticking to about the same, one every 18 hours. One every 18 hours, you break it down on a number of units per day, 350, thereabouts. I'm not signing a warning siren right now. They are launching and they are being absorbed, right? So developers are selling these projects. So they're coming to market, and it's someone like a top-tier developer, Ema, Majid Al-Futtaim, they're launching, and the launch is sold out at launch or very soon after, say within the same month, for the majority of the units. Smaller developers taking a little bit longer. As long as absorption stays high, that sales side is fine. The bigger question is, I'm buying something now, what's the market look like in 3 years when it hands over, and what's the intention for that property? If it's end use, probably not a lot to be concerned about. If it's for an investment to, say, get capital appreciation and flip, always be cautious. And if it's for rent, you kind of have to look at it. If someone's saying that it's yielding in the area now at 7 or 8%, no one knows what it's going to be like in 3, 4, 5 years. We can speculate, but oversupply drives down prices. And at some point, every market goes through it, and we are going to have a period of that in the future. The question is when.
I've seen a couple of distressed sales from the off-plan market, units that were being offered, not a huge amount below the original price, but below, because people need to shift them. Stuff that was due to be handed over 2025. Is that a worry?
So when you've got, say, 17,000 transactions happening a month and you've only got 2 or 3 distressed sales, probably not. Let's say even if it's 100 distressed sales that are out there right now. When someone buys a property that they're not paying upfront for the whole amount, they have to look at what payments are going to be due and when and make sure that they can afford it. My advice to anyone would be never buy thinking you're going to have the money. Have it, right? Know that you have it there, or be in a position where you might have to sell at a discount. Selling at a discount, I mean, it's very few and far between right now. Yeah, there are some there. We see the transactions come in, but you're talking less than probably 0.5%, even lower than that if we really run the numbers and crunch. You just don't see a lot.
Okay, so we've got mortgage activity as well at a 14-month high, second highest month on record. Now, you can only get a mortgage for something that's already built or something that is built enough to qualify for a mortgage. Are we finally tipping some of these off plans into column two?
It's very hard to get financing for a property that hasn't got a BCC, a building completion certificate, meaning it's complete, ready to hand over and be occupied. It's a process to go through. The developer has to be approved by lenders for this. There are very few that even choose to go through that process. So there are some that are getting towards handover where that's where you're seeing financing take place. Before handover, while it's still technically off plan, not so much. Yeah, most of the mortgage activity is still weighted in favor of new purchase mortgages. So a property purchased and mortgaged in the same month, I think it's 53%, 54% of the activity. Over that, that's a good indication of owner occupancy, right? They're going in, buying those properties. There's a healthy chunk of bulk mortgages that are in there as well, which typically developers, large investors, and refi activity has sort of tapered down a little bit as well. But the mortgage market is strong. Interest rate cuts, interest rate hikes. I don't think anything slows this down. You had almost the same name as me, Jean Walters, talking before. When are we going to see that next rate? I've always been saying after the elections. That December meeting is when we might see a rate cut. How will it affect the market here? Probably keep those mortgage transactions going up.
1 minute left with you. What does all of this mean, particularly that price appreciation that you mentioned earlier, for where we are in the market cycle? Are we hitting a peak?
We're edging towards one, right? We've come up, we're 10 and a quarter percent above the previous market peak. That market cycle, though, only lasted 2 years, that last market cycle. We're well over that right now, right? We're in 3+ years. It's been slow, steady, moderate appreciation for the most part, right? It's set, from all looking at all the indicators, to keep going. But you can never time the bottom and you can never time the top. Everyone wants to know, is it the time to sell? Is it the time to buy? It depends on your situation. For me, if you're not greedy, now is probably a great time to sell. You can lock in decent gains that you know are there. You can realize them. You can exit the market. It might go up another 2%, 5%, 10%, but you lock it in. I'm not talking to you, Brandy, to sell your
property. I was going to say, you're offering me your spare room, Zan.
If I have one.
Right, Zan Jahinki is the man in charge of the numbers for Property Monitor. He's the COO. He's the Director of Market Intelligence and Research at Cavendish Maxwell. Joining us this morning with his May report into what's happening in the Dubai property market, which includes the highest ever sales transaction volumes that he's recorded.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
A little bit of a precious gems focus for us today. Why? It's been prompted by an article in CNBC. Headline reads as such, "Diamond Industry in Trouble as Lab-Grown Gemstones Tank Prices Further." That's just the tip of the iceberg at the moment. We've been courting opinions. In fact, we've been putting together a bit of a who's who on this one. We've got the diamond dealer to the British jeweller. We haven't got a candlestick maker for you today, but we've pretty much got opinions left, right and centre. Before we introduce our British jeweller, let's just hear the thoughts of our diamond dealer from a little earlier on today. We were joined in studio by the Sanjeev Jain, the Managing Director of Ratan Sajan Diamonds, DMCC. And we were trying to get the thoughts on just how much of a hub is Dubai when it comes to diamonds.
The capital of the diamond industry used to be once upon a time in Spain, then it moved to Amsterdam, then it moved to Belgium, where it was there for a pretty long time, and now it is Dubai. It is Dubai, really. It's hard to digest, but yes, it is Dubai. It's very easy to move the goods here. It's very easy to import, re-export. The government is so friendly here. So the natural diamond industry is very good here.
So let's get the thoughts now of the renowned British jeweller, who, of course, is based here in Dubai. The CEO and the founder of Fergus James Diamonds is Fergus James. Join us live here in studio. Fergus, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you on board. Is Dubai a hub when it comes to all things precious gemstones?
I think it definitely is for natural rough diamonds, for sure. A lot of the natural diamonds that are on sale here, they start here, they get re-exported to India, they get cut in India, then if they're going to get sold in Dubai, they come back to Dubai. But for sure, Dubai is a really big hub for rough natural diamond trading.
You are a British jeweller by trade, but you've set up your business here in Dubai.
Yep.
Why?
It was a bit random. I mean, I was working here in another job. So I was CEO of a property asset management company, and I actually started the company as a bit of a side hustle. And then it kind of it just grew, and one thing led to another. And ultimately, I had to kind of give up my day job and pursue my passion kind of full time.
In terms of the industry, we want to turn our industry to that now. And of course, this inflammatory headline that's doing the rounds. I mean, it's caught our attention, but yep. Is this something that's been rumbling for a while? Is the industry in trouble?
I think the industry is in trouble, and I think that the introduction of lab-grown diamonds is what is kind of tipping the industry over the edge in some ways, and it's forcing the industry to go back and almost re-examine itself and reinvent itself. It's come very, very quickly, so it's kind of materialized pretty much out of nothing to something that's really dominating the market now in the US. I mean, to give you some statistics, you had like maybe 2% of engagement rings in the US being lab-grown diamonds in 2018. And 2022, 2023, you're talking 40, 50%. So it's got market penetration very, very, very quickly.
Part of this article in CNBC alluded to one of the names that is synonymous with the business and has been for generations. De Beers, obviously going through a little bit of a change as well.
True.
I mean, what's their play when it comes to lab grown? Is that something they've tried to be part of or control?
They try to be part of it. They try to control it, and now they've pretty much exited. And that all happened in the period of maybe 2, 3, 4 years, so a very short period of time. And I think that they try to direct the market in a certain direction, in that lab-grown diamonds would be like an introductory purchase, your first diamond purchase when you were 13, 14, 15, you know, late, early teens. And that kind of backfired. It didn't really work out like that with the consumer. The consumers were buying much bigger products for much more kind of significant events, if you like, and replacing what they would have normally bought, you know, the natural diamond. And that obviously didn't really work so well with De Beers' business model. So I think they had to, they've done a bit of a rethink of it, and they've split their light box business up now. And I think that all of the production facilities they have for lab grown, because they were growing their own lab grown, are being relocated to the US, and they're focusing more on industrial usage of lab-grown diamonds.
In terms of the influence that De Beers have had, I mean, they coined the phrase, didn't they? Diamonds are, a diamond is forever, etc. Yeah. Are they still as influential on your business, on the business as a whole, as they once were? Or is that, again, diversifying and changing?
I don't think so, because they don't have the market dominance that they used to have on the supply side. That's definitely changed. And I think they've also become complacent as being the kind of natural leader in the industry. And so, I mean, you can see this in the amount of money that's been spent on advertising in the natural industry has decreased a huge amount over the last 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, I can't remember natural diamond adverts from De Beers within recent times, but I still remember the ones I saw on the telly when I was a kid at, you know, back in the 1980s, back in the 1990s, Diamonds Are Forever. They were adverts that I didn't really pay any attention to because I wasn't into jewelry at the time, but I still remember they still left an imprint on my mind. So I think they kind of lost their touch a bit and maybe became a bit complacent with the advertising side of things. And then, you know, when that happens, obviously consumers can't really identify with the product as much, so they're more susceptible to change when an option comes along.
So look, it's an industry that is steeped in history, and you can get a number of different opinions, and people get very passionate when it comes to the opinions about all things diamonds. But let's sort it out. Let's look to the future as well. I mean, you sell jewellery, pieces of jewellery. You sell gemstones as well. You're selling to clients. I mean, are they buying natural? Are they buying lab-grown? Is it all to do with the size of your wallet or not?
I mean, the easy answer is that they're buying both natural and they're buying lab-grown. Okay. And the answer, I think, to the second question about the wallet was not one that people expected, and it hasn't got anything to do with the size of the wallet. We've got customers who are, you know, wealthy beyond all means and could afford to buy whatever they wanted, and they're still opting for lab. And that was something that, honestly, we didn't expect. And they're even mixing their purchase. So they might buy natural for one purchase and a lab-grown for another purchase, which is, again, something that people didn't really expect, you know, a year, 2 years ago when they were predicting what was going to happen to the future of the industry. And I think in terms of what's going to happen in the future, it's really down to... I mean, it's not clear. That's for sure, it's not clear. The market still hasn't sorted itself out. It's still pretty messy. And I think that a lot depends upon the investment and how clever the advertising, the marketing is from an industry level for natural diamonds, to see whether natural diamonds take a bit more of a bounce, because they've certainly been on the down for the last 2-3 years now.
I really appreciate your clarity and your clear thinking on this one, and I'm sure a number of our listeners and viewers will as well. Why? Because we've been talking about that misunderstanding, whether it's consumer misunderstanding industry or industry misunderstanding consumer. I don't know. If though people are heading out to buy a diamond this weekend with their loved ones or for their loved ones, what's the 101? I mean, is this a good time to buy diamonds? Is this a good time to buy jewellery and come to see you guys?
I mean, I'm always going to tell you it's a great time to buy jewellery all the time, right? So I'd say from both a natural and a lab perspective, prices have been falling for the last 2 years. I don't really see either of them falling much more. So if you've been planning a big purchase or a significant purchase for a while, then now is a good time to buy for sure. But I mean, again, I wouldn't really focus on diamonds of, and this is contrary to what most of the trade would say, I wouldn't focus on diamonds being an investment. It's a gesture. It isn't a good investment. If you want a good investment, then there are plenty of other things you can invest in, like, you know, crypto or stock market or whatever it is. Yeah.
Brilliant. Really nice to meet you. Yeah, really nice to have you here in studio. We'll definitely get you back for more in the future. Have yourself a lovely weekend. A busy weekend, I hope, after that little call to arms. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks
to Fergus James, the CEO and the founder of the eponymous Fergus James Diamonds here in the region. Our thanks to you.
Just the highlights. This is
is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Tech news this morning. Well, tech news for the last two mornings. Yesterday, NVIDIA joined the $3 trillion club. This morning, we're talking about the fact that they have caught the attention of antitrust regulators. Very pleased to be joined to discuss both of these things by Jessica Amir, who is a market strategist at Moomoo, joining us from Australia this morning. Jessica, NVIDIA's passed $3 trillion. Jessica, it's passed Apple. It's the second most valuable company in the world. We've got that share split even happening today. What's that likely to do? What effect's that going to have?
Well, typically, if we look back at history, we do know that the past five times NVIDIA has split their stock, they've rallied up about 23% to a new high before kind of normalizing. But we do know this split is really different this time. And that's because forward earnings, I guess, are over 98%. So the market is expecting 98% revenue growth for NVIDIA. There's no other company in the tech space or that has got a market cap of this size, indeed in the top 10 or 20 stocks in the US, that has got forward earnings this strong. So there is a lot of excitement, and it just means that their shares, instead of trading at $1,200, they're going to be back under $120, or indeed under $200 for the first time in 3 years. So it's a history-making event, I guess, if you will, but the fundamentals of the company are more exciting, and that's what is really getting Wall Street most excited.
You say there's no one else with this valuation. It's getting people who want to be competitors, though. Intel's coming out and saying it's launching chips. Saudi wants to build its own chip factories. Where do you see the biggest challenger coming from?
Well, I think for the next couple of years, we don't have to worry too much about competition. And the reason I say that is because we have to look at the facts and we have to look at forward orders. And if you are still looking at investing in NVIDIA, I guess you haven't missed the boat. But if you're thinking about 10 years from now, well, that's going to be a very different story. But this year and the next year and the subsequent years, we do know we've got forward orders already banked in. In fact, NVIDIA has got a lack of chips that they're able to get out the door. But the fact is that they've got the H200 chip that's rolling out at a 40% premium from this quarter. And then next quarter is very soon, just around the corner in July, they're rolling out the Blackwell chip. And the Blackwell chip, we already know you've got the biggest companies in the world that are already under contract and they've already forward ordered that. And then you've got this new chip that they're rolling out, the Rubin, the big Rubin, that's coming out in Q1 next year. So forward orders are coming thick and fast, and they're expanding the breadth of their client book, which is more exciting. So they're, instead of just having 40% of their revenue coming from the big hyperscalers, those tech companies that we know and use, the Meta, the Oracle, the Amazon, the Netflix, et cetera. Instead of getting their revenue from there, they're keeping those, but they're expanding the breadth of their client book. Now, of course, going into healthcare, remember. So they're going into partnership with Novo Nordisk, with J&J, with GE. And these contracts don't come to fruition. The revenue will hit their books later this year and then in 2025. So to answer your question, we don't need to worry too much about the competition. They were the first mover and they have 90% market share for good reason. So they're ahead of the game, and the fact that we just spoke about, you know, the Blackwell rolling out, the H200 rolling out, this is showing you that they are the leader. They're continuing to invest heavily in R&D and they're edging out the competition. They've got a pretty wide berth, so it's going to be hard to catch up. But 10 years from now, guess what? You're not probably going to see 100 or 200% revenue growth year on year for this company. It's probably going to be more likely to be in high double digits. Okay. So that means AMD and Intel can start to take market share.
Okay, we've got 1 minute left with you. That market share you're talking about has caught the attention of antitrust regulators in the US. They're going to investigate NVIDIA along with OpenAI. How much of a concern is that?
Well, I guess for those that are really glued to the detail of the company, the fundamentals, it doesn't change anything. Sure, it, naturally, when things like this pop up, it causes sentiment to, I guess, come on the back foot. So naturally, that's happening. And I guess you saw a little bit, a tiny bit of the wind come out of NVIDIA's sales overnight. But I think we should more be focused on where they're getting their revenue from, that's under contract. That's not going to change. A big company like Microsoft is not exactly going to pull out of their great strong relationship with NVIDIA. We should be more focused on potentially NVIDIA becoming the biggest company in the world if their shares jump 3%. And they'll probably look to do that over the next couple of weeks and kick Microsoft off their throne. So that's more what we're focused on.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Jessica Amir, market strategist at Moomoo, joining us this morning from Australia. NVIDIA has joined the $3 trillion club, but it's also caught the attention of antitrust regulators.
This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.